Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting, fun, and interesting episode of the OIG Roundtable. I've got my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, now a manager on our SIU team, and Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our payment integrity director. It's your resume just gets bigger and bigger. It's thank God you're not an author where you're writing papers and things of that sort. So, because you would have a 30 or 40 page long CV with all these jobs you've had. It's amazing that you've been able to manage to stay around here long enough.
You haven't caught me yet.
That is true. So, you know, today we want to talk. There's a press release that came out. I think it's probably a week or so ago. It came out regarding a settlement that Walgreens entered into with the U.S. Attorney's Office for about $107 million. I think it was like 106.9 or something. The fraud is a 2009 to 2020 fraud, I think, is the time period. And it was just under $107 million in fraud as a civil settlement. And it was relative to Walgreens billing government programs for prescriptions that were legitimately filled, but patients never picked up. And instead of Walgreens reversing those claims out, they just kept the money, put the medication back in stock, and then refilled those prescriptions for potentially other patients later on. So the reality is that at some point, you can figure out that they probably got paid twice for the same prescription. So, you know, the scheme is Eric Rubenstein has a prescription that needs to be filled. My doctor calls the prescription in, or I am on an auto-enrolled, right, auto-refill, which, by the way, in the Medicare world, if you are going to be involved with an auto-refill, you have to affirmatively opt in every year. That is a Medicare requirement under Part D. So if I'm on a chronic medication for an acute condition, you know, whether it be high blood pressure, glucose, cholesterol, who knows, a million different things that are chronic medications, in order for me to be put onto an auto refill program with any pharmacy that's billing my Medicare Part D, I need to affirmatively opt in. The pharmacy needs to maintain proof that I have voluntarily and affirmatively opted in. But for the Walgreens scheme, we don't know if these were from auto refills, if these were from initial fills, whatever it may be. And people choose to not pick up their prescription for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's cost. A person gets a prescription filled. The pharmacy calls them up, tells them they've got a prescription ready to pick up. The patient says, what's my copay? It's an insanely high amount of money for that patient to pay, whatever that amount is. And they say, oh, I don't want it. I'll talk to my doctor. And what the pharmacy is supposed to do is put that medication back in stock and then reverse it. While, you know, in the general sense in the pharmacy space, as some of you may know, it's a little different. When you get a prescription filled, it's actually a point of sale transaction. When you show up to pick up your prescription, you pay for the prescription, and that's the point when it's supposed to be billed. Whereas in traditional healthcare, your claims get processed by the billing office of your healthcare provider at whatever cadence they're choosing. But we're here, it's a point of sale type thing. And in this scheme, people were not picking up their prescriptions, and Walgreens was returning the medication to stock. Clearly, at some point, somebody else was getting that prescription filled, and so stock and inventory remained full, and then ultimately, Walgreens would then get to bill for that prescription again. So when we look and we see that this case settled at about $107 million, we don't know this because it wasn't in the documents that I saw, but it likely was a double damages case, which means that the fraud was really $50 million with double damages making $100 million. And obviously for these large pharmacy chains, the dollar amount of $100 million is a drop in the bucket when these are, you know, when these large chains are making an inordinate amount of money. Kind of in the aggregate. So $100 million is pennies to a lot of these. But, you know, the other case that Walgreens had had to do with insulin pens. That was also a ketamine. That was a $269 million case. That was out of Southern District of New York. I actually worked on that one for a little bit, helped out one of the agents that was on that case. And that one had to do with insulin pens. They came in a box from the manufacturer, five pens, I think, to the box. And the issue was that Walgreens was dispensing the full box, which had the package insert, the prescription label on it, all of that. And the government's allegation, this was also qui-tam, was that it led to over dispensing. So the patient might have gotten a box of five. They might not have used the five. The next month, they might have only needed three, but they got another box of five. And after 4 or 5 months, the patient has some inordinate overage of what they need. We see this a lot, by the way, with diabetic testing supplies also, lancets, testing supplies, the strips, the solution, all of that, kind of a similar thing. And both these cases were qui-tams or qui-tams, depending on who you're talking to, or what are known as whistleblower cases. And people that bring these cases are known as relators. And they tend to be a very strong piece of the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse continuum and become an important part of identifying cases and working cases. So, Wade, that's an important piece of the puzzle because, from the investigative perspective, and we're making this a little bit more of a broad conversation, but the thing that is interesting is qui-tams are filed by individuals who have what's called original source information or insider information and provide that information to the government relative to government programs. The piece of the puzzle that oftentimes people don't understand or realize is that private payers, commercial payers, and things of that sort are excluded because the qui-tam provisions are ponied off of the Federal False Claims Act under Title 31 of the federal law. So, but where this ropes into potentially an SIU investigation is that you could look at a settled qui-tam that's been disclosed, that's no longer sealed by the court. You can look at some of the facts from press releases and public documents, and it is a source of investigative leads for an SIU. But qui-tams are, from an investigational perspective, they can be really robust cases worth, in this case, we've got one case that was almost 270 million, another one for 107 million. So we're talking about well over $300 million, almost $400 million in cases just on Walgreens. And so from an investigative perspective, they are worth vetting, reviewing, and can really help with a roadmap and an investigational strategy. And I know you, me, Matt, we've all worked a ton of these. And they can be miserable, they can be great, but they certainly do work towards giving you a roadmap for an investigation. And in some cases, right, make a difficult or an impossible or an otherwise unknown case visible for an investigation.
Right. And in this case specifically, before we get into relators kind of in general, but this case specifically, it was brought to the relator's attention by a patient who had a recurring prescription at Walgreens. He went in to get it refilled at a certain point, and they said, "You've already had it refilled within the 30-day time period." And he's it's like, "No, I haven't. I'm due. I need this medication." And then they found out that exactly what you were describing had happened, where it was an auto refill. It went to the shelf for 10 or 15 days, whatever. It eventually was put back into supply because he never picked it up, but they never reversed the Medicare charge. So it was billed as though he had picked it up, and he didn't. So now he was short 30 days supply because you can only get so much medication. This was brought to the Walgreens employee's attention, who, looked into it a little bit further and discovered that this was a systematic issue. It wasn't a one-off system or one-off situation. So, as you were stating, the value of a relator to the government's case is it's like unprecedented, because it's in a case like this, we would not have known. In many of these relator cases, if not for the relator, the government would not know about the fraud, the situation. And in this case, yeah, perhaps the patient could have went to, called the OIG or something, and we could have learned about it that way. But even if that's the case, the typical OIG agent is not going to know about Walgreens, their billing system, the I forget what it's called, but the something plus system. So the relator who is you know, has spent years, and usually it's not just like an entry-level position. It's a CEO, a CFO, an IT person that has vast knowledge of the workings of, in this case, Walgreens. So he was able to look into the billing process and really understand, have a deep understanding that like an OIG agent would not have gotten from talking to the patient who is shorted 30 days supply because of things that are going on in the background that the patient doesn't know about. So the relator really is, in a good relator, makes all the difference that in a case. Sometimes we'll get relators that kind of have an idea of what's going on, and they have an allegation, but they don't know all the inner workings. And that's where a case really is made, when the relator not only exposes the fraud, but has the internal working knowledge to be able to sit down and explain it. A lot of times these initial interview, relator interviews, they might take, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours, maybe they'll have to come back the next day. It might be a 2-day interview because there's so much information that's passed along to the agent and the either the AUSA or the DOJ attorney. So it's really like a look into the working elements of the case that really wouldn't be available to the investigators or the attorneys if not for the relator that has that internal knowledge.
Yeah, and a lot of these interviews, you're right, they could go a day, 2 days. I mean, I know I've filled up notebooks, of notes, and you're talking about sitting and typing up, writing up, it's 4 or 5 days of sitting and just slogging through and writing it. And, one of the points you bring up, which is a really good and important point, is relators sometimes will be able to shortcut an investigation. And so your investigation strategy is sometimes already laid out because the relator has provided such granular level information that it makes it a little bit easier to identify. If someone just called in a complaint to say, hey, Walgreens is doing this, you might spend 6 or 8 months trying to figure this out, and you can certainly shortcut any investigational tie-ins that you need through the relator's knowledge. And at the minimum, relators can point you in directions to people and places and things. And in some cases, right, make a difficult case easier. In this one, the fraud appears to have been perpetuated, at least from the settlement agreement. What we see is that this fraud was perpetuated from 2009 to 2020. So the fact this was 11 years, right? And we see this kind of frequently when you look at cases that went on for years and years and years. This is something, first of all, if it was a $50 million or $100 million case, this is pennies on the dollar for a big company like Walgreens. So the dollar amount isn't going to raise much of an eyebrow. And if you consider it over 11 years, over the thousands of Walgreens locations, you could be talking about, a few thousand dollars a year from each one of the individual pharmacies that are out there. So it's not surprising that something like this in the aggregate would go undetected. Whereas, a single mom and pop pharmacy, this is going to come out, a little bit brighter because, you're talking about a concentration. Which, Matt, it gets to kind of that other point, which is, Walgreens had a civil settlement. The division was Boots Alliance on the on the insulin pens for, $270 million. And then here we go, a couple of years later, and there's another one. And the question that people will surely ask is, why isn't the government doing more? Why aren't they being excluded? Why aren't they being criminally prosecuted? And is there a disparity that exists? Because the mom and pop pharmacy that did this really runs the risk of exclusion, really runs the risk of criminal prosecution, the individuals that own the pharmacy. And we know that inherently over the years, there's been a change. It used to be that the government was very soft on the criminal prosecution of companies. You can't put a company in jail. But then, we did see some things that came out, the Yates memo when she was acting, AG, and a lot of the things regarding corporate malfeasance and corporate cooperation and being good corporate citizens, and the fact that companies can no longer, individuals that are sort of the driving factors for fraud, waste, and abuse cases cannot hide behind the corporate veil. But obviously, there's the, you know, the question of why isn't Walgreens being excluded when they've done this, but yet the mom and pop pharmacy is going to be, and, you know, why are we acting this way towards them?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors to that. There's access to care issues. There's also litigative factors that go into play where you're dealing with big time counsel for these corporations, and there's a lot of give and take with DOJ with counsel like that, rather than, you know, the call a lawyer person that the mom and pop shop might get. But one of the things I wanted to touch on before I go in more into that is with the relator. One of the things you also get from the relator is some pretty good information on intent, because usually that relator is not a present employee. They're usually a disgruntled former employee. They probably took that issue to someone within the company and said, hey, this needs to be fixed. And what happened was they didn't fix it. They fired them, or they moved them out of that their position where they had knowledge. So they have good information about intent. So that brings up, you know, that brings into the criminal aspect as well. So that's another good thing about relators. But going back to the big corporations, you know, I've had cases where there were quitams against, you know, nursing home chains, you know, where there were criminal convictions against a nursing home chain. Have you ever tried to exclude a nursing home chain? You know how hard it is to move those patients out of their homes? There's just factors that go into these things that you really don't contemplate. But another is these big firms. You can't shut down a Walgreens. I mean, that's, like you said it, thousands of franchises across the country. That causes an access to care issue for, you know, all patients, not just Medicare and Medicaid, but all patients. So those factors have to be taken into consideration, plus big bucks come into consideration. When they're writing a big check, one of the first big cases I had, and I'll talk about the source of that case in a minute to get back to the quitams, you know, was a hospital chain. And it was a specialty hospital chain, psychiatric hospital chain, heads in beds, bringing people in, paying kickbacks to referral sources, getting the people, devouring their coverage, and then kicking them out whether they needed the care or not. The whole bit. Caught them. They pled guilty. The corporation didn't plead guilty. A shell corporation that they created pled guilty to avoid the mandatory exclusions that HHS has in place. So this non-factor pled guilty. They paid a huge fine, and then they gave us some sacrificial lamb, medium to upper management people to take the hit on the individual side. Now, the source of that case for me was the former CFO of that hospital corporation. He was the one doing the cost reports. And had I not had that inside source, there's no way we'd make this case, because he was able to show that he would create the cost report based on real revenue, but then they would force him or ask him to sign the cost report that they were actually going to submit to Medicare, which inflated their costs, and so that they would get more revenue from Medicare as a result of the cost report submission. He refused to do it. He showed that they actually built an escrow account so that if they ever got caught, they had the money on hand to pay Medicare back for the difference between the real cost report and the one that they submitted.
Like a slush fund.
And he walked the DOJ through this. He walked, you know, myself. And without him, we would have never made the case. So getting back to quitams. Well, let me tell you, finish the story on that. So they pled guilty, paid a big fine. They had enough money in that escrow account that they went back and they bought another hospital chain with the money they had left over. So, and not to say nothing, but the owner of that hospital chain is now a senator from Florida. But I'm going
to skip back. They robbed Peter to pay Paul.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so this person that was my source, he went to work for a nursing home chain in DC, saw malfeasance there, filed a QUETAM this time. And again, without the expertise, I was with NASA at that point, but he was instrumental in bringing that hospital chain and some aspects of the DC government to bear on the relationship that they had built and the false claims that were being submitted. So it's important to have those relators in place. One thing I will say is, you know, I said I went to NASA. QUETAMs are not just healthcare. They are everywhere. Even at HHS, I had a QUETAM on a grantee, and you know, for ACF funds, Administration for Children and Family funds. They, you know, so it's not just there. At NASA, huge QUETAMs, usually by competitors, submitting QUETAMs against other competitors that are, you know, the allegations might be that they're using counterfeit parts or falsifying test results on the metal that went into, you know, the shuttle. Or the biggest one was one company hired the employees of another company, used those employees and the information they brought with them to underbid the first company and win major contracts with NASA. And, you know, that was $600 million in the QUETAM. Did they get excluded? No. You know, you're not going to exclude, I won't say the name, but you know, a major defense contractor. And they, so they continued. And as a matter of fact, they then merged with the other contract, the other defense firm that they stole from, to become, it's called the Launch Alliance. So that was all very interesting. But yeah, QUETAMs are a shortcut way of doing things in terms of you get all the information up front. You've got an insider. Sometimes they're still there. You wire them up. You can have a good time with that. The actual complaint outlines the fraud. And they are a wealth of information. Even as an SIU, you can get your hands on that information, and you can find whether your billing data matches what's being alleged in that complaint.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes when a settlement comes out, oftentimes there's a partial disclosure or unsealing, as they call it, of the QUETAM. When a QUETAM is filed, it is filed in the federal system. It is put up onto something called PACER, which is the electronic case filing system, which, by the way, is you can sign up for it. It's a free account, and you get X number of searches a month at no charge. And oftentimes when a settlement occurs, there's a partial unsealing. It may not be everything that's out there, but it can at least give you enough information to kind of see, you know, where things are. The thing that's interesting is in the Walgreens case is that if this was on a mom and pop, right, that there was the likelihood that the provider here, if it was a mom and pop pharmacy, would have run into a potential exclusion issue, would have run into potentially a criminal issue for doing this, because you know, you're basically billing for services not rendered, you know, as this goes. But this brings up kind of the, from an investigative perspective, and we've talked a lot about this in the PBM space, we've talked a lot about this in the traditional healthcare spaces, some of the challenges on information sharing and aggregating data and things of that sort. You know, we here look at that, you know, amongst our clients in our one New York market, where we've got a number of plans that we do SIU work for. If a provider is, you know, involved in a fraud, waste, abuse case for one payer, they're likely involved with it for another. For us, we can see that across some of our payers. But, you know, in the PBM space, what's interesting is particularly in an inventory reconciliation, this would have potentially been found had the PBMs had information sharing where they can see what the volume of prescriptions are. And I think, you know, there's something to be said. It's not like you're saying, hey, we want to give away the store. You don't want to give away necessarily competitive pricing information, things of that sort. I mean, this is why some of the payers, some of the hospitals out there, why there's this whole push against the no surprises and price transparency, and why the Office of Civil Rights is now ticking up their enforcement on failure to provide this data and this information. Because, you know, when one hospital is getting paid a certain amount from one payer and they're getting paid a substantially lower amount from another payer, you know, that hospital is going to want to get that higher amount from the two payers, whereas the payer paying the higher amount is going to want to pay the lower amount, and you have this kind of back and forth. But there clearly could be methodologies out there where the PBMs can work in concert with each other to say, hey, you know, Eric Rubenstein Pharmacy billed us for 100 aspirin. And then another PBM could say, hey, Eric Rubenstein Pharmacy billed us for 100 aspirin. And on an inventory reconciliation, you might find a problem, right? We've talked about this use of data, how a pharmacy that is nefarious in nature could be showing the exact same invoicing information to two PBMs, and it's going to pass muster on both. So, you know, a little bit of this is because of the dollar amount in the aggregate, because Walgreens is such a huge chain, this is a little bit of a needle in a haystack. And so you might never find this. And that's why relators, you know, kind of become important. I think we, you know, we all can agree, because we've all worked them, they can be inordinately frustrating cases, because the U.S. Attorney's Office tends to want to work them. And they can oftentimes be very, very time consuming. But the big piece of the puzzle is that many times these are cases you would never find if it wasn't for a relator bringing them, you know, bringing them forward. So, Wade, I kind of want to give you the last stab at this, because from that investigative perspective, vetting a QI-TAM is sometimes a little different than vetting data analytics or a partial complaint or an anonymous complaint. There may be a substantial, and I mean, we've sat in, you know, and you know, I'm sure you have as well. I know I've sat in many of these relator meetings where you show up, and the whistleblower and their lawyers come in, and it's four binders that are 1,000 pages each, where it's really granular information. And so there is a different level of vetting QI-TAMs than there are other cases.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times when you have that initial meeting with the relator and their counsel, a lot of times we won't know anything about the case. It's like I'm coming in blind. I'm just like an open book here, and they're about to tell me everything that's going on, because it's, as you said, that it's something that we would not have known just from our normal sources. It's all coming from the relator and his or her experiences within the company. I think also much kind of unique to a relator type case is you'll have that long drawn out initial interview to kind of get the nuts and bolts of the case, but then you're going to, because they are so intricate and complex, you're likely going to be meeting with that relator on an ongoing basis. Like either you have recurring meetings once a week, or you're just constantly calling them, because they have so much knowledge on the fraud and the situation and the processes that you can't, even if you do have an 8 hour, a 16 hour interview, you can't learn what they've learned over the, you know, past decade or however long they've worked there. Right. So you will be speed dialing them, having questions for them for the remainder of the investigation, probably at least for the foreseeable future. You're still going to have to be reaching out to them and getting additional information from them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's never a one and done, because as the investigation unfolds, and, you know, if you have a relator who's a current employee, you know, they can be a source of information where they can continue to feed, you know, investigative leads and things of that sort. So it is an important piece of the puzzle. But for, you know, for me, I think the point is that for those that are the regular viewers of this, and know that we work very hard on these podcasts to talk kind of from the SIU investigative perspective, I think this gets back to that whole premise of intelligence gathering and liaisoning with law enforcement and things of that sort. Because, you know, every time there is a press release on something, has your plan been affected? Now, for a mom and pop pharmacy who has a large case like this, there's a likelihood that the money's gone, right? The money may not have even existed, but it may not be gone. But when you're talking about a Walgreens, and, you know, if your personal plan has been affected, or a hospital chain or something where there's still money potentially out there. But at the minimum, from the SIU perspective, you should be looking at your data and seeing, do you think that you have been adversely affected by whatever the allegation is? Have you been affected in some negative way, you know, on this? And I'm not saying that there are SIUs. I don't think any SIU is sitting twiddling their thumbs. But you have to think about, how do you continue to invest in protecting the plan's dollars to be spent in a way that the plan feels is appropriate, right? I mean, we'll have people will argue that money isn't being spent by the plans and things of that sort. But I think when we're talking about things from the payer side, it's how are we going to be spending our money appropriately for the care that's being provided? And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, an area for SIUs to look at is always going to be things like press releases. And then particularly when you've got something where there may be some additional documents out there, like on PACER or partially unsealed KETAM, where maybe either codes are out there, CPT or HCPCS or an NDC code for medications or something, where you can at least run some data from an intelligence gathering perspective and see, have you been adversely affected? And if you have, to what dollar amount? And do you treat that dollar amount as an offset? Do you do something with it? You know, how internally, how do you handle it? But, you know, when you see KETAMs coming out, you know, and keep in mind that relators have a financial stake. Nobody files a KETAM out of being altruistic. People are filing KETAMs because there's a financial incentive. If you're the relator on a KETAM, you're entitled, if the government intervenes and it results in a settlement or a victory at a trial, you are entitled to between 10 and 15% of the amount that's recovered. Now, if the government chooses not to intervene and you as the relator with your lawyer choose to pursue this on your own, you're entitled to up to 25% or 30%, I think it is. It's 15 to 25% if the government intervenes, and it's up to 30% if the government doesn't intervene. Ultimately, DOJ kind of has the final say on that amount. And I've seen instances where the relator's lawyer did not agree with the government's amount when they did not intervene. I worked on a project recently where the government did not intervene. We prevailed on the case. There was a settlement. The government ascribed a percentage that they were willing to pay the relator, and it was a fairly low percentage. And the relator's counsel said, no way. The government did nothing on this case. We should be entitled to the full 30%. Went to the mat and wound up getting, I think, close to that 30% because it was really, you know, equitable to do that. The government was basically not involved in any of the case. They declined it. So there is always a financial incentive in cases involving relators and KETAMs. When you look at a case that results in a $300 million settlement, the Walgreens case, you know, that's real money. Obviously, the relator's counsel is entitled to a percentage. It could be somewhere in the 35 to 40% range, give or take. But the other piece of it is that attorney fees are also covered. And that's the key point, is that relator's counsel is entitled to a percentage of the recovery based upon a negotiation between the relator and the lawyer. That's separate. But the attorney is made whole for their they negotiate ultimately attorney fees, but the defendant in these cases has to pay the attorney fees. So the settlement amount, so if a relator is getting $10 million, attorney fees don't come out of that $10 million. The lawyers on the relator side get made whole by the defendant having to pay the relator's attorney's fees, but they make their extra money on a percentage that they take basically off the top. So relators, attorneys, essentially, there are some instances where they actually get a double pay. They get paid an hour, they get paid for the work that they did as the lawyer, and then they get a portion of the recovery for their effort, so to speak. So there is a huge financial incentive from the whistleblower perspective and from the relator's attorney, relator's counsel perspective to resolve these. So you can't ignore these cases. We're seeing press releases on these kind of cases all the time. And from the SIU perspective, it is certainly something to look at. We could probably talk in a podcast or multiple podcasts about individual KETAMs that we've worked that resulted in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, my largest KETAM was a $340 million case. And some of those cases, you know, ultimately can result in criminal and civil cases, administrative. There's a whole slew of things that can come about as a result of that. So, you know, we wanted to highlight this because it's kind of an interesting case because it was two KETAMs within just a few years of each other against the same, you know, pharmacy chain. And I know that when I talk about these cases with people, the very first question that people ask is, why aren't they being excluded? And, you know, to coin Matt's phrase, you know, we didn't really get to talk about it, it's too big to fail. It's, you know, excluding a pharmaceutical company, excluding a large chain like this, there's always that issue of access to care and access to quality care and things of that sort. And is there a level of inequity that exists in the marketplace that a mom and pop pharmacy could have could have been excluded, could have had a criminal charge against them, the individuals could have been excluded on top of the criminal charges, a civil case, a lot of collateral things. And the argument that people always make is, well, why aren't they excluding Walgreens? And you have to think in some areas, Walgreens might be the only pharmacy in a 20-mile radius, or be in an area that is otherwise inaccessible to people. In, for example, an urban area where the only thing that might be there is a Walgreens. So, you know, there's this push-pull that exists on what is right, and then what is, at the end of the day, going to present itself where there is going to be an access to care issue. So I am sure we're going to have a lot of discussions about that, because people are going to argue that with that lack of equity, it's creating an unfair marketplace. And we don't want to have that discussion here, but it is certainly a discussion that's worth having. So important stuff. Keep reading those press releases. Keep sending them to us. We'll continue to talk about them. Always good to have you guys, and keep signing up for our newsletter. And, you know, we're coming close to 37,000 followers on LinkedIn. We appreciate that. Join us on LinkedIn. You can get your newsletter. You can get our weekly podcasts right in through the newsletter, right in through LinkedIn. We've got a bunch of LinkedIn Lives coming through. And of course, you can get all of this through our website, advizehealth.com. So thanks as always for joining, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.